He was an undergraduate student at Harvard from 2000 to 2006. And now he's finishing his PhD at Yale, and his advisor is Karen Lehu. And today he will tell us about bipartite fluctuations and the problem of many-body entanglements.
Hi, thanks for the introduction. I'm told I'm a little overdressed, but I heard I was going to be on TV. So. So I'll be talking a bit about this work I've been doing with Herman on connecting fluctuations of charge number or spin with quantum entanglement. So entanglement is, I know it's said a lot, but it is sort of what distinguishes quantum systems from classical systems. And we know this is true because when entanglement was first studied in the early days of quantum mechanics, it sort of played a central role in trying to figure out if quantum mechanics was a fully satisfying theory of reality. You know, you had these debates between Einstein and Bohr and so forth. But as we started developing things like quantum computers and protocols for quantum cryptography and quantum communication, I think it's sort of now more considered a resource that we can use and try to utilize for our benefit. And then more recently, there's been this trend of applying those things that we learned from quantum information science to many-body systems and try to figure out if there are new things we can learn about many-body systems from that. And I just have an example of a build pair there. But, so I put traditional in quotes because this is always probably what we will do when we talk about quantum many-body systems. But I'll sort of talk about what we traditionally consider many-body physics, which is first we look at the energy spectrum. We look at ground state energy, see if there's a gap between the ground state and excited states. And we look at correlation functions, you know, whether it's Green's functions or density-density correlation functions, because those have to do with, A, they tell us things about long-range order, and B, because when we apply perturbations to our systems, those are the things that tell us how the system is going to respond to it. And of course, an incredibly important thing is that we look at phase transitions involving symmetry-breaking order parameters. And so if you look at Ising models, for example, you would get non-zero magnetization and so forth. But I think we've recently learned definitely that there are states of matter that are not fully characterized by sort of this Landau formalism. And topological states of matter are an important example of this. The first paragraph of a lot of papers on topological insulators lately is exactly that, that the Landau formalism that's been working for us for so many years doesn't quite capture everything about the system. And so we start talking about topological invariants and so forth. And I think there's been belief that entanglement can tell us something about studying the structure of entanglement in these systems can tell us something important about these systems. And I'll mention some other reasons why we would want to study entanglement in the first place. So the basic idea behind a lot of the studies of entanglement is that you take a many-body system, here you see this sort of square lattice, and you sort of single out a part of the system called A. There should be colors, but it's not quite showing up here. And you trace out the degrees of freedom that are outside your system. When people talk about entanglement entropy in connection to black holes, it's actually the opposite way, because stuff inside the black hole you don't know about, but stuff outside the black hole you sort of know, and so you want to trace the inside of that out. But anyway, I won't be talking about black holes today. You just, if you take a many-body system and you trace out some part of the system and consider just those degrees of freedom that are inside the subsystem you're talking about, one of the important things that comes out of this is that a boundary is formed between your subsystem and the remainder of the system, and this area turns out to play kind of an important role. But it's definitely a different perspective on things in the sense that instead of considering sort of local quantities or point-point correlators or energy spectrum, what you're considering is how does the system inside, how is that entangled with the outside of the subsystem? And so, like I said, you take a full system. Usually you want to study a pure system because once you get to mixed systems like thermal states, then you're considering more classical fluctuations. You take a pure system and you trace out part of a system to get this reduced density matrix. And then there's sort of, I would classify the approaches to studying this in two ways. One is to, you know, study how entanglement entropy, which I'll define below, how entanglement entropy scales with system size. You can look at other things like bipartite fidelity, where you change a small parameter in the system. Oh, so that's a little bit different. So let me move on to valence bond entanglement entropy, where you consider your system to be in a superposition of valence bond states and try to figure out how the inside is connected with the outside. But the more popular approach recently has actually been to study the full entanglement spectrum. So what you do usually is to take the reduced density matrix and then sort of write it, pretend that your subsystem is in a thermal state, which it probably isn't. But this defines this Hamiltonian H. And you can always do this because the density operator is just some positive operator. And try to pretend that this Hamiltonian has low energy modes, which would correspond to the dominant eigenvalues of your reduced density matrix, and try to figure out if there's anything universal to learn from that. And so this is not really the subject of my talk, and I don't work on this as much, but just to sort of motivate for people who don't study this a lot, if you look at the simplest kind of topological insulator you can kind of look at, which is called a Chern insulator, it has these topological invariants called the Chern number, and you can it just comes out as a function of the parameter m here. But one of the things that's critical to topological insulators is that if you put your topological insulator and give it physical edges, you'll get these edge modes that are topologically protected. So to give you an example, so here in part A, this is just the energy spectrum as a function of transverse momentum. Because if you put an edge on the system, you lose translational invariance in one direction. And you see that there is a gap. And I'll come back to this in a bit. But if you go into the topological phase, you see these edge modes that connect the two occupied and unoccupied parts of the system. And you can also see this, it turns out, in the entanglement spectrum, which is shown here. But what's critical is that you can study this in a system where you don't have any edges. There are no physical edges to the system, so that experimentally you wouldn't see any chiral current flow. But then, which is why you don't see any spectral flow here, which is where there's an edge mode that connects these two bands. You can see that in the entanglement spectrum. And so there's been a lot of investigation recently of looking at how there's a bulk edge correspondence in topologically ordered states, the bulk, and then the edge that comes out of. So this is a virtual edge, by the way. So there's no real physical edge, but you can study the edge states through the entanglement spectrum by putting in a virtual split in your system. And so this is sort of to motivate the fact that entanglement spectrum can be quite important. So to relate this to more of what I've been working on recently, so let me just quickly get some definitions out of the way. So the entanglement entropy is when you take the reduced density matrix of your system and basically compute the von Neumann entropy of that reduced density matrix. And it's basically a generalization in sort of classical information theory of Shannon entropy, where you would just take the probabilities and do minus p log p. And then a slight generalization that's kind of useful for theoretical reasons is what's called the Rainy entanglement entropy, and you can see that if you take the limit as alpha goes to 1 here, you recover the alpha equals 1 case, which is the Rainy entropy. From a linear algebra point of view, you can consider this as what's called a Schmidt decomposition. So if you take a pure state of a quantum mechanical system, so it's some vector in Hilbert space, you can decompose it into states that lie in one subsystem and then the remainder. And then compute the entanglement entropy this way. Or in this case, I've just computed the powers of the reduced density matrix. The fact that whether I consider my subsystem A or the remainder B, the coefficients are shared by them, means that I can take the reduced density matrix corresponding to either subsystem or the remainder of the system and get the same entropy out, which is kind of important because this implies a certain symmetry between with respect to subsystem choice. So this means that if you take a large system, and then your subsystem is tiny, and then the remainder of the system is huge, even though there's such a huge difference in volume, your entanglement entropy will be the same. And so heuristically, the argument is that the important information is stored in the boundary between the two subsystems, because it can't be stored in the volumes, because then the symmetry wouldn't exist. So some important properties of the entanglement entropy is that you if it's a product state, meaning the two parts of your system are completely disentangled, then you get zero entanglement entropy. Like I mentioned, it's symmetric between the subsystems. And then there's some technical consequences. And just to give you a sense of what's been done so far, So one of the most important results to date has been this sort of result from CFT that says in one dimension or one plus one dimensional theories, the entanglementropy is incredibly universal. So it only depends on the central charge of the underlying conformal field theory, which tells you the universality class of your critical state. It turns out you can transform between infinite systems to finite systems or to finite temperature systems simply by conformally transforming your problem. And then there's been some rigorous results on area loss for quantum lattices where the entanglement entropy will scale with the area of the subsystem. And this turns out to be pretty important. So I also want to bring up the fact that Hilbert space, I think somebody once said, is gratuitously large. So the fact that entanglement entropy scales with the area of the system, area of the subsystem is kind of unique. Most states in Hilbert space will have volume scaling. And so the ground states that appear in sort of realistic Hamiltonians turn out to be fairly special within Hilbert space, where there's a lot of states that we probably aren't that interested in. An important violation of the area law occurs in free fermions, which is again kind of weird because bosonic Hilbert spaces are actually quite large compared to fermionic Hilbert spaces where you can only have a particle occupying or not occupying a state. But because of the non-locality of fermions, it turns out that they actually have this mild logarithmic violation of the area law. And there's been some important results in this area. Topological entropy, entanglement entropy was a big thing for a while because it turned out there were universal corrections to the area law in topologically ordered states. And then more recently, like I mentioned, there's been a lot of studies of entanglement spectra in fractional quantum Hall states. And of course, a lot of work being done here on understanding the role of entanglement in numerical algorithms like DMRG. And then their generalizations to sort of projected entangled pair states or multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatzes. Because this entanglement also turns out to play an important role in our ability to using classical computers to simulate quantum systems. But one question, somebody once said that if you want to introduce a new quantity into physics, you have to make sure you can measure it. But this is one area where theoretical progress is far, far, far ahead of any kind of experimental detection. And so there's one way that in principle you can measure entanglement entropy, and this is used in for people who are using quantum Monte Carlo methods to compute entanglement entropy, which is you can create multiple copies of your system and do kind of a swap. And you can measure the expectation values of those swap operators. And this is actually essentially the principle that's used in derivations of CFT results and so forth. But this is extremely abstract. The idea of starting with multiple copies of a system and swapping subsystems of it is rather abstract. And so one of the results that we've found recently is that, at least for non-interacting fermions, you can relate the entanglement entropy exactly to fluctuations in charge number. So here I'm just writing down, because I'll be referring to this a bit. So the cumulance of charge number of fluctuations is going to be given by derivatives of the cumulant generating function. And the chi of lambda here is, for our purposes, just the expectation of value of this operator here. So the limitation to non-interacting fermions is, on the one hand, kind of severe. On the other hand, not as severe, because besides the inherent importance that free fermions have, these are also described sort of spin half XX chains in 1D, hardcore bosons, the integer quantum Hall effect, which I'll show an example of. And again, as I mentioned before, topological insulators are mostly studied in the non-interacting case. And then something that I've been sort of trying to stress to people is that actually number fluctuations studied in this way is actually already kind of important, because if you think about full counting statistics, people who study mesoscopic transport, where you have one lead and another lead, and there's some scattering region, and you count the number of particles that have gone through a scattering region, that turns out to tell you a lot of information about your system. And so this, what I'll show you is sort of a real space version of full counting statistics, and this has sort of been interesting for me. So first of all, why number fluctuations? So one reason is that number fluctuations are also symmetric between subsystem and remainder of the system if the total number is conserved. And so you already know that it's going to be sort of sensitive to the area, like the entanglement entropy. And it turns out all even cumulants are like this. And so you figure if there is a relation between entanglement entropy and fluctuations, it's going to be between the even cumulants. And that turns out to be the case. We know that fluctuations are not exactly like entanglement entropy, because unlike entanglement entropy, you can create systems where the fluctuations are zero, but there is still entanglement. So a simple example is if you have two Luttinger liquids that are coupled just by density-density interactions, then because there's no tunneling, particle number in each leg is conserved, but you're still going to have finite entanglement. So fluctuations are not the full story behind entanglement, but you'll see that it is for a lot of large class of systems. And as I mentioned, this sort of actually initially came up in the context of quantum point contact. So in a quantum point contact, you might start off with two electronic leads, non-interacting leads, decoupled, and then you would connect them. And then as a function of time, try to figure out how are the left and right leads entangled with each other. By the way, before I go too far, I did want to mention that fluctuations are also something natural to compute in the context of DMRG, where these numbers come out pretty naturally. So one way to compute fluctuations, it turns out, is just sum all of the correlation functions within the subsystem. But within DMRG, where you're already keeping track of all the different U1 sectors, this comes out naturally. And of course, in quantum Monte Carlo, you can compute SC pretty simply. So let me just state the results. So we found that the entanglement entropy can be expressed as a series of this form. So Cn are the cumulants of the charge statistics. And these alpha n are coefficients that depend on a cutoff k. And they turn out to be dependent on what are called Stirling numbers. And these just kind of pop out in combinatorics problems. And the essential thing here is that the reason it looks like it's written in an overly complicated form with this limit taken afterwards and so forth is that the order of limits matters. If you take the cutoff to go to infinity and the coefficients first, and then just sum it over an infinite number of terms, this turns out to be divergent. And I'll show you why this happens. The Stirling numbers, like I said, come out in combinatorics problems. So it turns out if you just take the cutoff to infinity, you get what are just the Riemann zeta functions. And these can be, for large n, these just converge to a constant. So if you go back to the series, if the coefficients are going to a constant, but the cumulants, which tend to diverge factorially with factorial number, that means the series is not going to converge. And so this was a problem that we found initially with this series. So that's what this series fixes initially. There was an initial result that started out with the wrong cutoff order. The reason this is possible, the reason it's possible to connect entanglement entropy to number fluctuations in non-interacting fermions is that in non-interacting fermions, it is possible to write down the entanglement entropy as a function of the Green's function matrix. It's also possible to write down the generating function as a function of the Green's function matrix. So you can imagine that by inverting the relations, you can write down an expression for entanglement entropy in terms of the charge fluctuations. And this is basically the idea. So let me first show you the wrong derivation. I put wrong in quotes because A, you could use the original series as far as if you applied some kind of divergent resummation thing, but we feel that for experimental purposes where you would have a finite number of cumulants, this is highly impractical. So you should definitely, this formula is way more practical. But the other thing is that it turns out for Rényi entropies, the series are convergent. And so we'll show you the general derivation. So you start off with the spectral density function for M. And in terms of the spectral density function, you can write down the Rényi entropies quite simply. And the details aren't that important, but you'll see that essentially the idea is that from this integral here, because the spectral density function can be written in terms of the cumulant generating function, and the cumulant generating function can be expanded in a series in terms of cumulants, you can make a substitution and try to term by term integrate. And when you do this, you get some complicated expression that in the limit alpha goes to 1. Remember, the Rényi entropy is in the limit of alpha goes to 1, reduces the von Neumann entropy, or the entanglement entropy. And you find the series that was originally found. The problem is, in this integration step, you are integrating essentially over the whole complex plane. And generating functions tend to have cumulant generating functions tend to have poles in the complex plane. So when you're trying to integrate something over the whole complex plane, there are poles. This causes you some problems. And that is why the original series diverges. It actually turns out the poles of generating functions also contain some interesting information. And this is something that I've been sort of working on with some people at Geneva. So this is a simple example of where these cumulants diverge. So you can see that it diverges factorially. So for systems like this, you would never get the right answer using the original formula. And we find that by using this new formula, which I'm just going to skip the derivation, you can get this series. So one useful thing, actually, is that not only can you get the entanglement entropy and the Reni entropies from just looking at charge statistics, you can also get the full entanglement spectrum from the charge statistics. And this has to do with a math trick that I did not discover. It was already there, and I just kind of found that this was applicable. So if you write down the Reni entropies, and you can write down the trace of the powers of the density matrix in terms of the Reni entropies, then it turns out if you form a certain kind of matrix here, so there's ones on the diagonal, and then 1, 2, through the dimension minus 1 on the upper part of the diagonal, and then you can write down all these Reni entropies along these sub-diagonals. It turns out, in terms of that matrix, you can write down this polynomial that contains all of the eigenvalues of your reduced density matrix. So remember, as long as you have the Reni entropies, which we can write down in terms of charge statistics, you can write down the polynomial, the characteristic polynomial for your reduced density matrix. And so in this way, you can compute the full entanglement spectrum just using the Reni entropies, which in turn are calculable from the charge statistics. So for non-interacting fermions, the problem of calculating entanglement entropy, Reni entropies, or the entanglement spectrum is fully solved, essentially. This actually still works. This formula still works for interacting systems. It actually doesn't matter what the reduced density matrix looks like. But of course, computing the Reni entropy for general interacting systems is actually quite a difficult problem. And here I just give a simple example of, so for example, if you have an unentangled state, then the matrix E that I defined before looks like this. So your characteristic function looks like this. So your eigenvalues are all zeros or ones, which means that the states are unentangled. But let me go back to the formula that we had, so give you some examples of how this works. So here I consider just a XX model in 1D, so spins interacting XX in the YY directions. If you start with a pure case where the coupling is constant over the entire chain, this is the standard spin 1/2 XX chain, and this also describes hardcore bosons and optical lattices in 1D, so this has practical implications, especially because with hardcore bosons, you can actually do these, you can actually count the number of particles in a site in real experiments, and this is recently with Greiner et al. Doing these quantum microscopes. They can actually count, they can take pictures and count whether a particle is there or not. And so in this way, they could do these measurements. And then later on, I'll consider a case where the J's are random, and this actually turns out to flow to what's called an infinite randomness fixed point. So here's an example. So this is for periodic boundary condition, and this is for open boundary conditions. And the top line is the exact entanglement entropy that you compute. And then these the lines below are showing how, as you include more and more cumulants, the answer approaches the exact entanglement entropy. So if you were doing an experiment, you can just use this formula and just compute the charge statistics, and then just add it in to try to figure out the entanglement entropy. So in this sense, entanglement entropy in non-interacting systems is measurable, which I think is kind of a big statement. Of course, if you look at the number of the cutoffs, you do have to include a lot of cumulants. And as far as I know, for non-interacting electronic leads, measuring in experiment the high-order cumulants is still a difficult process. You can measure high-order cumulants in sort of quantum dot experiments, but of course there you have an interacting problem. It turns out for the second cumulant, which is essentially the variance, you can do some analytics on this. So first of all, these are results that were computed analytically in the periodic case and then sort of conjectured in the open case for the entanglement entropy. So you see that the coefficient here is 1/3 because the central charge for non-interacting fermions is 1. So it's 1/3 log and then plus some constant. And then for, so look at this form. And then for the fluctuations also, we computed this analytically. And you can see that it's log L divided by pi squared. And so the ratio there turns out to be pi squared over 3, which is what comes out of the above formulas. And then we have some other formulas that we derived analytically for the open boundary case, which turns, you have all these sort of log L over L corrections or log L over L squared corrections in addition to sort of 1 over L, 1 over L squared corrections. Anyway, so this is just a comparison of the entanglement entropy with just the second cumulant. And you can see that already the scaling is extremely similar. And then another example is, so for the strongly disordered case, it turns out once you get to the infinite randomness fixed point, the ground state is just a whole bunch of valence bond singlet states that cross the boundary between your subsystem and the remainder of the system. And so the entanglement entropy is just, you just count the number of valence bonds that you have in your system. And so it turns out that you can, again, because you can describe this with a disordered XX chain, you can fully compute the entanglement entropy from the fluctuations. And then, I don't want to give too many examples, but these are more examples from quantum point contacts where I give you the exact entanglement entropy, and then, you know, as a function of the number of cumulants that are included, you can compute the entanglement entropy. Another example is if you have free fermions in 2D. As I mentioned before, for free fermions, you have this logarithmic correction, and so this is actually plotted as a function of the logarithm of L. And you can see that, again, these things converge. I'll just give you one last example of this working, which is that you can do this for integer quantum Hall states. So integer quantum Hall states are described by, you can describe them as in terms of non-interacting fermions. And I give this example because usually you hear that fermions have this L to the D minus 1 log L scaling with this logarithmic correction. But it turns out that you can also have gapped non-interacting fermion states. And the integer quantum Hall state is an example where if I take a cylinder geometry like this and I cut the system this way, then I can get an area law that looks like this. And again, I'm showing sort of the comparison between the entanglement entropy with what's computed by including the charge fluctuations. So there's a point that I'm trying to make in all these slides is basically that for non-interacting fermions, anything you can do with entanglement entropy, you can also do with the cumulants. And so this is kind of an interesting statement. If you go to interacting systems, the situation is much less clear. And the reason is that for when you're in basically a single particle picture, the entanglement entropy of your system can be roughly thought of as, where is the particle? Is the particle in your subsystem, or is it not in your particle subsystem, in your subsystem? And so in that sense, it's a pretty simple picture physically. For interacting systems, this is no longer true. And you can even come up with systems, as I mentioned, where you can have zero particle number fluctuations but finite entanglement, because the entanglement can be generated not just through hopping of particles. But one thing you can still look at is, you know, how do the cumulants behave with subsystem size, and does that in any way similar to entanglement entropy? It turns out, for example, for Luttinger liquids, this is true. So if you take a Luttinger liquid, which describes, you know, interacting fermions, interacting bosons in 1D, XXZ chains, even fractional quantum Hall states for the edge states, this has sort of a quadratic Hamiltonian. And so that means that it basically, you can describe, well, so if you can describe the density operator as a derivative, which means that the integral over the density operator within some part is actually just the difference in this operator phi, the charge operator. And so it turns out in a very, very standard Luttinger liquid calculation, you can compute the fluctuations as depending on the Luttinger parameter k, and it scales logarithmically just as the entanglement entropy scales logarithmically with system size in conformally invariant systems. So as an example, you know, you might consider the XXZ chain. And you can actually just go in and analytically sum over the correlation functions to get that the fluctuations in an XXZ chain, the leading term depends on the Luttinger parameter. There's a constant correction. And there's actually subleading corrections that oscillate. And you can derive all of this analytically. What's interesting here is actually that This term is generated in the spin-spin correlation function from a term that goes like 1 over r squared. And then this term comes from a term that goes like 1 over r to the 2k. For the xxz chain in the critical region, k you can consider to be between 1 half and 1, which means that generally when you talk about the long distance behavior of these correlation functions, this is the term that you would think was important because this is what survives. But actually the dominant scaling of the entanglement entropy, the logarithmic scaling, comes from the 1 over r squared term, which is what you would consider the short distance behavior. And so it turns out, like the entanglement entropy, these fluctuations are sensitive to the short distance cutoffs. And this is actually sort of from a practical numerical point of view, a pretty simple way to extract Luttinger parameters. And I'm showing this as a numerics comparison to beta ansatz. So this is the Luttinger parameter k as a function of the anisotropy in your system. And of course, the delta equals zero portion is the free fermion case where k is one. And so this, later on I'll show you an example where you can do this for the Bose-Hubbard model also, because there are RG theories that tell you what should k be at the transition point, and if you can extract this simply. So this is traditionally done in DMRG using correlation functions, but this you can extract with much less effort and much more accurately using just the fluctuations. Just as a physics interesting thing. So when delta equals one, it turns this into the isotropic Heisenberg model. And it turns out there you have some marginal operators that add some bigger corrections to the logarithmic term. So one of the things that we considered was what's called the Haldane-Shastri model, which is a Heisenberg model, but without those marginal operator corrections. And so it turns out you can compute the fluctuations in this case, just the variance, analytically, and this is what we get comparing them to DMRG, and so just like a nice exercise. And as I promised, there's the Bose-Hubbard case where you can compute the Luttinger parameter and then try to figure out where it crosses to. And in comparison to sort of what was done with Monte Carlo and also previous DMRG results, we get the transition point quite accurately. So from a numerical perspective, this turned out to be pretty useful. I mentioned before that there was some similarity between the fluctuations and the entanglement entropy in CFTs. And you can kind of see this pretty easily because within CFT, the generating function is essentially what they would call a vertex operator. And we can compute this based on just CFT arguments pretty simply. So you know that it's going to scale like, you know, some coefficient times the logarithm of the system size, and then ask what does this need to be? And you can actually find this coefficient by considering the fact that if I go to finite temperature, eventually the entanglement entropy, so your subsystem will behave like it's been coupled to a weakly coupled to a bath, which consists of the remainder of the system. So eventually these fluctuations should converge to what you would normally consider particle number fluctuations in a thermodynamic system. And because from standard thermodynamics, you would see that this goes to the compressibility of your system, you can immediately determine that the coefficient that goes in front here of the logarithmic term should be a function of the compressibility times the velocity that's in your system. And this, of course, is consistent with the fact that in Luttinger liquid theory, the Luttinger parameter you can write down in terms of the compressibility. And so, you know, you can write down this sort of relation that says in CFT, you get roughly a relation where entanglement entropy and fluctuations are related by pi squared over 3, which is a number we had for non-interacting fermions, and then modified by some ratio that that depends on the central charge for the entanglement entropy and the compressibility for the fluctuations. So in some sense, this generalizes the non-interacting fermionic result, but it is not clear, definitely for sure, whether, unlike in the non-interacting fermionic case, where we know that you can account fully for the entanglement entropy in terms of charge statistics, it is not clear to me whether the entanglement entropy in an interacting CFT is fully accounted for by the fluctuations. But it's nice to know that they scale the same. Another difference actually you see when you talk about, so sometimes people are interested in not just a contiguous subsystem, but a subsystem that's like sort of disjointed. So here I have a ring system where I take one subsystem and then the same subsystem, but like they're sort of spatially separated. And I can look at the entanglement entropy between those, you know, this part and then this part. It was initially thought that the entanglement entropy would scale some generalized version of the of the usual scaling. So you have to just have to put in many, many different combinations of the distances. And it turns out the fluctuations also scale that way. It turns out the fluctuations result is correct, but the entanglement entropy result is not. And this is one of those subtle things in CFT where the way you get the CFT result is that you basically create multiple copies of your system, and then when you trace out the part that you're not interested in, you connect the parts that you are interested in, and that forms a sort of complicated Riemann surface. And then the magic of CFT allows you to conformally map that onto a plane, essentially. They use the same method when the intervals were disjoint. And the assumption was that there exists this conformal mapping from the complicated Riemann surface to a plane, and it turned out that doesn't exist. And so they got the answer wrong initially. But again, this is a case where entanglement entropy seems to be a bit more sensitive to the sort of non-local geometry of the problem compared to fluctuations. And in higher dimensions, you also see some differences. So this is an example where we went and studied the anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg model in 2D, which, of course, orders anti-ferromagnetically. So basically, the rough intuition is that because there are Goldstone bosons, because of the gapless boson in 2D nature, you would have an entanglement, an area law for the entanglement entropy. And you can indeed find an area law. So here, it's not quite clear. So you divide the entropy divided by, you compute the entropy divided by L to see if it stays a constant. But because of a logarithmic correction, you see this sort of going down. But like there is in fact an area law for the entanglement entropy. And I showed this at APS last year because we wanted to compare. This is the result that we found, and then this is the result that was found by Quantum Monte Carlo by a different group. And we just wanted to show that the results were extremely similar, except that this took many less probably computing cycles, I imagine. Whereas the fluctuations in 2D scale with a log correction, which you think, okay, well, so this is a problem because entanglement entropy and fluctuations seem to scale completely differently. In one way, it is a problem, but it turns out also to be useful. So if you consider a system, a slightly generalized version of the Heisenberg antiferromagnet, and you take the coupling to change between alternating chains, you have a phase transition where you go from a sort of a nail ordered state to a valence bond ordered state. The entanglement entropy is not sensitive to this. It turns out it's just an area law across the entire phase diagram. But the fluctuations are. So in the nail ordered phase, you would see something like the fluctuation scaling with the area times a logarithmic correction. Whereas in the other state, you would just have an area law. And so you can distinguish the two. And in fact, our collaborator, Nicolas Laflorency, has used that to detect the phase transition between those two phases, using just the fact that in one phase, it scales with the area, and then the other phase, it scales with the logarithmic correction. And then this is just a comparison with normal methods of computing the phase transition using the stiffness, I believe. I haven't really talked about gap systems, but you can imagine that in gap systems where correlations sort of decay exponentially, that area laws will be satisfied by basically all quantities that you would want to measure, including the fluctuations and the entanglement entropy. So, like for example, a big example for this is the AKLT state, where you have a state that is completely described by valence bonds. And this is, of course, kind of an important example for states for like matrix product states, for example, where this actually there are AKLT states that are exactly described by matrix product states. And so that was kind of an important example for why DMRG worked. I know there's some like disparate things in my talk, but so the first part I was trying to stress the fact that studying many body physics from this quantum information point of view has yielded a lot of interesting results. Sort of our contribution to that field has been that for non-interacting fermions, you can, you know, potentially measure entanglement entropy, Rényi entropies, entanglement spectrum, et cetera, using just charge fluctuations. And then I think for interacting systems, it's kind of still pretty open to what extent you could measure this in a realistic system. And then something that I haven't quite stressed, but like we've been working on recently, are that you can just look at the fluctuations and they turn out to be pretty interesting. So when I showed you the images of the topological insulators before, I showed you that the entanglement spectrum has this spectral flow where there's a gapless edge state that connects the two, you know, otherwise separated states. Those you can also derive purely from the zeros of the generating function for sort of a full counting statistics type problem. And so it turns out the full counting statistics, or just measuring the fluctuations of particle number within a subsystem, can tell you some information that you normally wouldn't associate with charge number fluctuations. And so that's it.
Special about non-interacting systems versus interacting that allows the charge fluctuation to give you the full entanglement spectrum, and what approximation breaks down in the interaction limit?
Yeah, it's just that in non-interacting fermionic systems, there is a way to write down the problem such that essentially what you end up computing is the entanglement entropy seems to only depend on whether your particle is, the probability of your particle being found within the subsystem you're considering or not. So that's directly related to charge number, right? Because charge number fluctuations just have to do with particles going back and forth. And so that's why in non-interacting fermionic systems, charge fluctuations carry the full information needed to determine entanglement entropy. When you have interacting systems, the entanglement is not necessarily just generated by particles hopping back and forth. So the example I gave earlier was that you could just imagine a system, you imagine coupling two systems that otherwise are disconnected, and then just allow sort of n times n interactions, so just density-density interactions, then particle number would be completely conserved in those two subsystems, but they're going to be entangled. So like if you consider Luttinger liquid ladders, you can definitely compute these things and find that there's some finite entanglement entropy.
More questions?
Yeah,
Sorry.
If you have particle number conservation for different species, How does this affect the result? So does it mean the entropy also scales and would scale as independently for the two particle numbers?
Well, so what you would do is, like, for example, if you put spin into your system, right? So
okay.
If you had fermions with spin, what you would do is just count the total n up plus n down, and you would get that relation.
Right, but suppose that you have two types of particles which interact, but with particle number conservation independently?
Depends on whether those two types of particles interact with, those two are still quadratically coupled or not.
Okay, right, because your results apply to free theories.
Right, so essentially you would have problems where one type of particle turns into another particle.
Right, but that's different.
Yeah. So that seems a bit unrealistic.
Questions?